Now, NAFTA negotiations are currently underway in Montreal. The North American Free Trade Agreement facilitates open trade between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Estimates show that NAFTA accounts for about $1 trillion of trade between the three countries. But despite NAFTA's importance in U.S. international trade, it has not always been popular before or after it came into existence. And most recently, President Trump used it as a political talking point and argued that the United States was getting the short end of the stick in that agreement and in world trade in general. Mark Koplovich is with us. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, NAFTA was controversial, not just in the United States, as it came into existence. Can you talk a little bit about the hopes and fears when NAFTA was signed into effect?
Yeah, so NAFTA actually started in the 1980s as the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, and then Mexico was added in the 1990s. And the hopes of trade agreements are always, you know, we know from economic theory that the idea behind trade is countries will specialize and produce what they produce relatively most efficiently, and that will lead to lower prices, more products, increased international trade, and that's good for consumers. It's generally good for economic growth. The fears and the political problems are that creates winners and losers within countries, right? If you're importing more goods into the United States from Canada or Mexico, that often is coming at the expense of firms that used to produce those goods at home and are facing greater import competition. So you get, it's good for consumers, it's good for American export firms, it's bad for American firms that are competing with Canadian and Mexican firms.
And on a political level, in a presentation I think you did on this, you talk about, okay, there's this good that comes out of it, out of a free trade agreement, but it's heavily dispersed. You might pay $20 less for the TV and a few bucks less for the toaster. That doesn't motivate political action. But the people who are hurt by it, who are laid off at a factory, that is a very acute loss for them, and that's more of a political motivation.
Yeah, so when we think about the politics of trade, you have these very spread out or diffuse benefits. We go into the store, there's more things imported from China that are cheaper that we buy on Amazon or in Target, but the costs are very concentrated. Right, you have certain industries, or you know, geographically concentrated, that an auto factory is going to go out of business, or a furniture factory is going to go out of business because business is picking up and moving, jobs are picking up and moving overseas, and especially in a political system where you have geographically concentrated districts, like we do in Congress, you get you get cleavages domestically, geographically across parties, that people are opposed to trade. And in general, we think that the losers from trade mobilize more because they're feeling the pain more than we're, you know, as consumers, feeling the benefits.
Now, President Trump has been making the case not just that individual regions in the United States are losing out on free trade, or that groups of workers, though he's talked about that. He's making the case that the United States as a whole is losing out in NAFTA, in most trade agreements that he's talked about. We are losing one
yes.
way or another.
Yeah.
How do we evaluate something?
So,
like that?
You know, President Trump and his trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, the Trump administration thinks very much in a mercantilist sort of way where trade is zero sum, right? If one country is running a bilateral trade surplus, they're winning, we're losing. That's not generally how we think about trade. Going back to the 18th and 19th century and the ideas of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, again, that, you know, trade benefits both countries or all countries, but that you have these winners and losers. You know, I think the U.S., Canada, Mexico, economic growth, economic activity over the last 20 years in the aggregate has not been harmed and likely been helped by NAFTA. But again, you know, you have these very politically sensitive winners and losers. And it's not difficult to understand why this sells politically, because you have parts of the country where people are seeing jobs moving overseas, plants closing, entire industries that are disappearing. And there are lots of reasons for that, right? It could be automation, could be globalization, it might be trade. But trade agreements are a very concrete thing that a political candidate or a president can focus on, is this is the thing that's causing the harm.
It seemed like free trade really took a beating in the last presidential election. It wasn't just part of Donald Trump, the candidate's appeal, but Bernie Sanders, his appeal was against things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Hillary Clinton was ultimately forced, it seemed like, to a back away from free trade agreements that she had talked up in the past. This was a potent political force in 2016.
Yeah, and I mean, it's historically always been a potent political force. And again, if you think about the reasons why, the benefits of trade are widely dispersed, but political candidates don't get campaign contributions from, you know, the angry milk consumers of America who might be upset that milk is more expensive because of agricultural protection. But there are sectors of the economy and firms that are contributing to on both sides of the political aisle, and trade. You know, it's hard to be ardently free trade if the constituencies that you're depending on and the dollars you're depending on in terms of campaign contributions are from firms or sectors that want protection.
We're talking about NAFTA, free trade, the World Trade Organization, and more with Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Want to get into some recent news, not directly NAFTA-related. The White House saying, hey, we're going to have some tariffs on a couple product lines, solar collector components and washing machines targeting, I think it was South Korea and China.
Yes.
Talk about, are these symbolic largely? Are these a significant financial punishment for those countries, and for what?
So there are a set of trade laws on the books in the U.S., and as part of our membership in the World Trade Organization, a set of temporary trade barriers you can put up if you are facing a surge of imports and for other reasons. And the Trump administration has announced that it's going to put up these barriers. What that means is that the prices are probably going to go up for consumers. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, for a long time we thought about trade as we produce things and sell them overseas and other countries do the same. You know, with the globalization of production now, a lot of firms that are producing in the United States are importing inputs into production from overseas. So the idea that this is going to create jobs or help the American economy, it's difficult to see that, because actually what it's going to do is raise the price of solar panels. It's going to raise the price of washing machines. That may help Whirlpool. And it may help geographically to save a few jobs. But what I've seen in the news in terms of the solar industry is that's going to raise the cost of production. That's going to lead to declines in construction that may hurt economic growth. It's not as easy to say we're protecting jobs at home now when firms, right, that contribute to growth and employment now are going to face higher costs on their imported inputs.
Let's talk about China a little bit. A lot of people, and this is not just President Trump, have said China is playing kind of dirty, even under the terms of the World Trade Organization and various agreements. In the past, they had manipulated currency to their benefit. Now they have these barriers, among other things, saying you want to sell here, you want to build here. Great. Share your trade secrets with us. A lot of state support for industries. Is it fair to say China is cheating a little bit?
I think it's fair to say China's cheating a little bit. It's obviously, you know, it gets complicated in the sense that all countries cheat to some extent, right? And part of the reason that we have a rules-based international trade regime with the World Trade Organization and trade agreements like NAFTA is to set up dispute settlement mechanisms and rules for what happens if countries cheat. Right, that we don't want to get into trade wars where we're putting up massive tariff walls and disrupting trade, that the U.S. can take China to the court in Geneva in the World Trade Organization, or can take Canada and Mexico to the NAFTA dispute court. So, you know, in the past, China was undervaluing its currency. They do subsidize certain sectors. They do, you know, they haven't lived up to all their WTO obligations. But that's actually true of the U.S., it's true of the EU, it's true of Canada, that countries don't fully comply with the rules of international trade. And that's why the U.S. and the sort of major economies of the world have championed since the 1940s having international organizations with rules and dispute settlement mechanisms. And so the big departure with the Trump administration is we're going to start to think about walking back from that. It's not clear, if you think that China's cheating, that that's necessarily the way to get them to change their behavior.
An argument from the left over the years against many free trade agreements is that we have environmental standards here, minimum wage standards, maybe labor protections here.
Yeah.
The people making this argument say those are good things, but they raise the cost of production. So a country we're competing with that doesn't have those things has a built-in advantage.
Yes, and that's true. And, you know, we think about trade-offs when we think about the politics and economics of international trade. That is part of why some countries have lower costs of production overseas. If you think about a Vietnam or a China producing textiles or sneakers or something overseas. But in general, the U.S., you know, as an industrialized country, we're abundant in capital, we're abundant in human capital, have a very highly educated workforce, that our comparative advantage in international trade is in services and high-end manufacturing and things like that. And developing countries are labor abundant, they're resource abundant, that they have a comparative advantage, and they would probably still have a comparative advantage in those things, even if they had, you know, higher labor standards. And it's not to say normatively that we shouldn't pursue higher labor standards and environmental standards in trade agreements, but having those in trade agreements wouldn't bring all of those jobs back to the United States.
I think you touched on something that's been a big issue in the politics of the last year or two. We have a highly educated workforce that can do some of these high-end, high-value things. Not everybody is in that category, and
yes,
the jobs that are hurt by trade, I think it's fair to say, they're the ones that the person with a lower level of training or a lower level of education could have gone to and gotten a decent living. The bad effects of trade are disproportionately on this group of people.
Yes, and we think about high-skilled versus low-skilled labor, or, you know, capital benefiting but labor not. And that's definitely true, and that's the difficult political trade-off is if you want the aggregate benefits in terms of economic growth and benefits to consumers in terms of price and variety of goods, you're going to get that with international trade, but you're going to get these tensions that some people are winning and some people are losing. And then that gets into, you know, interesting and tense domestic political debates about policies to compensate the losers, to retrade them, should we expand social welfare programs, and things of that sort. Closing off international trade might help those people, right? Might save jobs in those sectors of the economy and in certain firms in the United States, but then you're going to lose the benefits of international trade. So unfortunately, there's no free lunch where we can have all of the benefits but none of the costs.
Mark Koplovich is with us right now. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, with us to talk about NAFTA and free trade and answer your questions. You can share your thoughts and questions now at 800-642-1234. As NAFTA is renegotiated, what do you think needs to change? Do you think it's been a net benefit or cost to the United States, to your community, to you? What are your general thoughts or questions about international trade and the agreements that relate to it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Mark Koplovich. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We're talking about international trade, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, and other issues in free trade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about trade? What are your thoughts on NAFTA, whether the United States should renegotiate it, get out of it, as the president has threatened in some cases? If you work in manufacturing or farming, how do you see international trade affecting you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Katie is with us in Sparta. Katie, hi.
Hi. My name is Katie, and in 2005, as part of a study abroad, I went to Mexico, and as part of that visit, I was able to meet with a group of Zapatistas who were, it's a group that formed January 1st, 1994, after Emiliano Zapata, they're named after Emiliano Zapata, the group's leader, and they were formed in response to NAFTA going through in Mexico. And one of the unique things that I got to do was not only meet with this community that was against NAFTA, but also meet with an economist. And one thing that I noticed is they just didn't have the technology there. So when they're sowing corn, they're doing it by hand. And they're doing so many things by hand because they just don't have the technology. And when NAFTA came about, their exports, such as their corn and any other goods that come from the country, that tax, you know, the free trade eliminated their tax basement, or eliminated a lot of their tax base, and And that's, I mean, if you look at the economy of Mexico, there's a pretty sharp decline.
Katie, I want to jump in and give our guest a chance to respond. And a lot of countries around the world are not happy with U.S. agricultural exports and agricultural subsidies that help make those possible. Can you talk a little about how that plays out in NAFTA? Mark?
Yeah, so I think what Katie is talking about is actually, you know, identifying that for Mexico as well, there are these domestic winners and losers from trade. So, you know, American agriculture is actually competitive in export markets, and Mexican agriculture in certain sectors, as Katie alluded to, may not have benefited. But there were a lot of jobs created in northern Mexico with American auto companies coming in and setting up plants. And so again, you have, you know, this idea of specialization and comparative advantage. Trade is benefiting Mexico as a whole, and it's leading to job creation in some sectors, but it's actually taking away jobs in other sectors. And we see this across countries, the proper nouns of which sector or which industry are benefiting and losing from trade and which geographies are benefiting and losing differ. But these tensions we see in every country when we're talking about globalization.
Some people would argue that the beneficiary in that situation is the auto company, who gets to pay less for workers, and maybe the big food companies that are, it's not the workers ultimately, it's the corporations that get this international flexibility to cut costs.
Which is true, but then it's also by extension American consumers, right? Because you're lowering the cost of production of automobiles, and then, you know, American consumers, Mexican consumers, Canadian consumers are getting cars produced you know, more efficiently at lower cost. And that's the difficult discussion, right? So that is great as a consumer, but if the GM plant is closing, right, in Janesville or, you know, in Ohio, then you have these, you know, parts of the country that are saying this is not working for us.
Katie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Tristan in Appleton. Tristan, hi.
Hello. So first off of all, I'm a political science student from UW Oshkosh. And I'd just like to say that I think we need to also keep in mind that this, like Trump's talk about free trade deals, comes in with the America First idea. So I think geopolitically, we need to keep in mind as well that there tends to be a sort of parent country protecting free trade, like, you know, keeping countries safe so that they can protect it. So I think in connection with, like, the U.S. pulling back a little bit militarily from across the planet, we've seen the lowest troop counts since Vietnam around the country or around the world. So I think we need to keep that in mind. This is also a bit in connection with the U.S. wanting to be less involved with world politics in general.
Tristan, thanks a lot for the call. The U.S. Bearing the cost as the world's policeman is the phrase. we pay a lot as Americans in a way to guarantee free trade in some ways. Is that right?
Yeah. So we, you know, the term we use to think about this in political science is hegemony, right? That you have a hegemon, which is the most powerful state in the international system, is bearing the burden of providing an open trade and financial system, of providing international security, a nuclear umbrella, right? Helping out our NATO allies, intervening in military affairs around the world. And that we do that in part for the stability of the system, but in part for selfish benefits that we benefit overwhelmingly. I think the point is very well taken, that the Trump administration's approach to international trade is part of a broader approach to international relations, that cooperation and mutual gains and the United States bearing this burden, even though we benefit the most, that we need to pull back and we need to focus on America first. And so you can't separate the security and the economic implications.
Tristan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to David in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just you haven't said anything about balance of trade. Mm-hmm. The United States has been running a balance of trade deficit, about $40 billion a month for probably a generation or two. Mm-hmm. And doesn't that amount to a huge transfer of wealth from this country, as they, with the surplus, the other countries are able to buy into our stock market, buy real estate here?
Got it, David. We're low on time. Mark?
Yeah, so, you know, the difficulty is there are actually two sides to the national balance sheet. So you have the current account, which is the trade balance and government spending, and then you have the capital account. And they're mere images of each other. So we are running a trade deficit with the rest of the world. What that means is there's a net inflow of capital into the United States, and that is good for the country, right? That is foreign money coming into the country, investing in the United States, financing American consumption. And it's very difficult for a country which issues the world's reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is about two-thirds of global foreign exchange reserves. People want to hold dollars all around the world. So it's very difficult, actually, for us to run a trade surplus with all of that money coming in. And this is something that the Trump administration, I think, misses, that there's a capital flow side that might be contributing to trade balances. It's not just we're spending more on the trade side and that we're losing.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking about NAFTA and U.S. trade deals in general with Mark Koplovich. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.